We're looking at the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation. We talked some about the beast from the sea, and we were looking at verses 9 and 10 as we concluded last evening. It stresses the inevitability of persecution and death for the faithful when the beast made war against the saints. And we pointed out that this same kind of persecution could possibly be the plight of some of those who are here with us, or all of those who are here with us at this time. It may be our destiny in the future. We don't know. To lay down our lives in loyalty to the Lamb. We just need to be prepared to do that if that case comes to view. So there is a call here for patient endurance and faithfulness that applies in every generation of time. It appeals to steadfastness. Now, under Constantine, the government of the church, the state church, was arranged to conform to the government of the state, to be the same kind of government. The emperor himself assumed the title of bishop. He regulated the church's external affairs. He and his successors convened councils at which they presided and determined all matters of discipline. The bishops corresponded to the magistrates that were in charge of a single city, and the metropolitans corresponded to the proconsuls or the presidents of the provinces. So they took the old structure of the Roman Empire and made it the governmental structure of the church as well. The authority structure was a far-reaching change from the humble status of the church during the first three centuries of the Christian era. Bishops became wealthy. They became solicitous of honors. They became quarrelsome. They became less open to differences of opinion in dealing with them. Authority given by the state to the bishops included civil as well as ecclesiastical jurisdiction. When Constantine moved the capital of the empire to Byzantium in 330 AD, away from the city of Rome, he could then rely on the bishop of Rome with some of the other Western bishops to maintain both ecclesiastical and civil order. There persisted an aura surrounding Rome and the Roman bishops because this was known as the See of Peter, and we talked a little bit about that. When the barbarians wreaked havoc on the Eternal City, as it was called, in the 4th century, starting about 410 and so forth, proceeding on from there up till the fall of the Western Empire in 476, the pagans argued that Rome had perished because she had turned away from the pagan gods to Christ. If you just stuck with paganism, everything would have been fine, they said. And that's why Augustine wrote The City of God, saying that yes, the city of the world had fallen, but the reign of the city of God had been ushered in. Justinian, the Byzantine emperor, acclaimed Rome as the head of all the churches in 533 AD. The bishop of Rome became known, and his name was John II at that time, the bishop of Rome became known as the universal bishop, or the lord of the church, the papa, or the pope, as he was called, the holy father, as he is often called today. This gave the saints over into the hand of the little horn. The woman, as we saw her in chapter 12, had been fleeing into the wilderness and then flying into the wilderness. In 533, she arrives fully into the wilderness, and we have the beginning of the 1260 years. Pope Pius V declared that he would sooner release a culprit who was guilty of 100 murders than to release one obstinate heretic. He would turn loose somebody who was guilty of serious, egregious crimes rather than to let a heretic go. The failure of the Church of Rome in our own time to prosecute heretics, even within her own priesthood, she doesn't prosecute them. I think this is one of the biggest evidences that we have that Babylon has actually fallen so far as her temporal power is concerned. One of the most convincing things, because every time she had the power to do so, she always persecuted the heretics. Make no mistake about it, if the Pope was Lord of our land, he would never tolerate you. He would never tolerate me for teaching these things. When he wielded his temporal sway, millions were tortured and slain. There's one place at Madrid called the Quemadero They didn't know exactly where this was. Quemadero means the burning place, and they knew it had been there, but they didn't know exactly where it was until they opened up a trench for the construction of a highway back in 1870, and they ran on to the human remains of just untold numbers of people. A commentator by the name of Henry Grattan Guinness reports having been present and standing chest high in human remains in this trench that had been opened for the construction of this highway. Here's what he said, quote, "When the Quemadero was opened at Madrid in 1870 and the ashes of the martyrs who had been burned by the Inquisition brought to light, we were present and saw that thick bank of human remains and stood breast deep in the ashes." He also says, "We have seen in Mexico skeletons of victims of the Inquisition who had been buried alive and visited the Inquisition in Rome and seen its prisons and conversed with its inquisitors. Its history, written in tears and blood, fills, next to the story of the crucifixion of Christ, the darkest page in the records of humanity." Now, this Quemadero was just one of 12 such burning places in the country of Spain. And Spain was just one of this tenfold area in Europe that was under the power of the papacy. So you can imagine how many people being burned to death would it take to have ashes up to your chest? And that wasn't all of it. That was just where they happened to dig there. This was a huge area, and there were 12 of those in Spain. How many people were put to death, God only knows. But it was not a thing that was done in a corner, and it was done for centuries. There was a lady by the name of Gisela Mueller of Richmond, Minnesota, who made this statement one time about her experience growing up in Nazi Germany. "I grew up in a Roman Catholic family in Hitler's Germany. One day when the Nazis had committed yet another act of church persecution, my mother angrily said, 'Why can't they leave the church alone?' My dad answered quietly, 'It could be worse. They could be buddies.'" And that's just exactly what happened during this time we're talking about. We have the combination of church and state. The church makes the condemnation, and the state would go out and do the burning or putting to death in whatever the method that they were using at that time. How does papal Rome blaspheme God? There are papal claims to divine authority that are very well documented. The papacy claims to be uniquely ordained to represent God on the earth. Many popes have claimed to take the place of God on the earth and even to be equal to God, even to be God. Few examples. Leo XIII, June the 20th, 1894, said, "We hold the place of Almighty God on earth." Pope Pius IX said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," referring to himself. Pope Pius XI, April 30th, 1922, "You know that I am the Holy Father, the representative of God on the earth, the vicar of Christ, which means that I am God on the earth." Cardinal Manning, a good friend of Pope Pius IX, said that the papal church is totally supreme, or it is nothing, or worse than nothing, an imposture and a usurpation. That is, it is Christ or Antichrist. And he's exactly right. There's no middle ground here. There's no room for neutrality on this. You have to agree. It's either Christ or Antichrist. It's one or the other. The papacy has openly claimed to be a law unto itself and to have authority to change existing laws. Remember Daniel chapter 7. He shall think to change times and laws. And this is true whether they're ecclesiastical laws or civil laws, even the laws of Christ. Pope Gregory IX wrote that the Pope is said to have a heavenly power, and hence he changes even the nature of things and can make something out of nothing. A judgment which is null, he can make to be real. In the things which he wills, his will is taken for reason, nor is there anyone to say to him, "Why dost thou thus?" For he can dispense with the law. He can also turn injustice into justice by correcting and changing the law, and he has the fullness of power. Pope Nicholas, from 1447 to 1455, decreed, "No marvel if it be in my power to change times and laws, to alter and abrogate laws, to dispense with all things, yea, with the precepts of Christ." The Pope is judge, and he can be judged by nobody. In their heyday, the popes were kings as well as priests. They claim to be subject to no power on the earth and to be king of kings, and for ages they acted accordingly to that. The spiritual authority attached to the Pope gave him headship over all things. This was the principle of his usurpations. This authority derived from his being the supposed successor to the Apostle Peter. The Roman papacy clearly speaks as Antichrist, that is, as a counter Christ. By that we mean a substitute for Christ. Remember in 1 John 2:18, the statement was made there by the Apostle John, writing to Christians in the first century, "You have heard that Antichrist is coming." And I put 2 Thessalonians 2 because I think that's where they heard it, from the pen of the Apostle Paul, who talked about the man of lawlessness, the man of sin, who was going to sit in the temple of God proclaiming himself that he was God. He'll sit there as God. I think that's what the Apostle John is talking about here. An Antichrist is a counter Christ, a substitute Christ, a vice Christ. And this expression was apparently well known in the early church. "You have heard that Antichrist is coming," said John. The expression, when you put anti in front of it, as in Antichrist, that either means one who stands in opposition to Christ or one who puts himself in the place of Christ. Another Christ setting himself up as the counterpart of the true Christ. We have the expression antitype in the English language. It's something that takes the place of a type. The tabernacle in the Old Testament was the type, and the church is the fulfillment of that. It's the antitype of the true tabernacle. It's the true tabernacle at which the Lord pitched and not man, and takes the place of the old tabernacle which symbolized it. So it's an antitype. It denotes a relationship of correspondence between the symbol and the thing that's symbolized. Antichrist denotes not per se one who rejects the person of Christ or the teaching of Christ, but one who is a rival, who usurps the office and usurps the prerogatives of Christ. He sits in the temple of God proclaiming himself to be God. He's the head of the great apostasy predicted by Paul. He's the little horn having eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. A pseudo-apostolical antichrist who sets Christ aside while in mouth confessing him and professing himself to be in the place of Christ, to be the power of God. Actually, the word antipope has been used sometimes in the past in this same way. An antipope was one who claimed to be the pope but was really a rival usurper of the actual pope who was in office at the time. So these anti-expressions, I think, are relatively well known to us. You know, there is a system to, there's a spirit to every system of teaching. In John's day, there was a class of teachers who had arisen within the church, claiming to be inspired, who denied that Jesus Christ was come in the flesh. These Gnostics were just one permutation of the spirit of Antichrist. They degraded both the deity and the humanity of Jesus. They failed to confess the true union of the divine Christ with his human nature. To pervert the essential doctrine of Christ by word or action is to deny him. The idea of Antichrist is not connected with atheism, but it's connected with heretical Christianity. All false teachers are of an anti-Christian spirit, even when they pretend to be of Christ, and even though they teach much that is true. But the common first century expectation of a future Antichrist was probably based on Paul's prediction of the man of sin, the son of perdition. John is saying that many already were around who had that spirit, even though it hadn't come to its full development yet. You've heard that Antichrist is coming. Well, the spirit of it is already here. So they were all around. There were little Antichrist around, but the one that they were pointing ahead to hadn't come yet and would not come for hundreds of years. The spirit of Antichrist was not an outright repudiation of the Messiahship of Jesus. The Pope claims the prerogatives of Christ in forgiving sins, for example. He sits in the seat of Christ on the earth as the vicar of Christ. That word vicar comes from the same word as the term vicarious, which we all understand. He speaks for Christ. And if you're going to speak for Christ, you must either be his true ambassador or be Antichrist. There's no neutral ground there. If the Pope is not the vicar of Christ, then he must be Antichrist. There's no middle view because of the claims that he makes. Pope Pius IX stated, "I am the vicar of Jesus Christ, and I have the right to employ the very words of Jesus Christ. My Father, those whom thou hast given me, I will not lose." Pope Pius X said, "The Pope is Jesus Christ himself, hidden under a veil of flesh. All must be subject to him." The doctrine of the Pope is that the Pope is the vicar of Christ is fundamental to Roman Orthodoxy and to the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church is on the side of Satan. I don't take any pleasure in saying that, but it must be said, it needs to be said, because that's exactly what's being talked about here in the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation. It's possible to have the spirit of truth, that is, a love for truth, while being wrong about some things. Conversely, it's possible to have the spirit of error while holding much truth, being motivated by the same spirit which characterizes the world. The prediction was in Daniel that another king was going to rise among those 10 horns. Another little horn was going to arise that would be different from the earlier ones. And the saints were going to be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. But we're told in Daniel 7, 25 and 26 that the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end. And that starts happening at the end of the 1260 days. The popes, in their reinterpretation of Scripture, annul marriages. They annul the commandment against idolatry of images. They withhold the cup of communion from the laity. When Jesus said, "Drink ye all of it," but they keep that just for the priest. They worship angels and saints. And it's really a perverse system that has developed over hundreds of years. Pope Pius IX said in 1912, "The Pope is the head under whom no one can feel himself tyrannized over because he represents God himself. He is the Father par excellence because he unites within himself all that there is that is lovable, sacred, and divine." The Pope is actually called the husband of the church. How could you usurp the Lord's position any more than that? He is the husband of the church, and in the inauguration ceremony of the Pope, he is given a marriage ring to wear that signifies that he is the husband of the church. So that's a little bit about the beast from the sea, which ushers in the papacy. Now, what about the beast from the earth? We read this last night, so I'll not read it again. I think most of you are pretty familiar with it in verses 11 through 18. The beast from the earth. Daniel, at his distance of an extra 700 years before the Apostle John, Daniel saw only one beast here, where John sees two. I think it's because of the extra distance. Just as when you look out through a telescope of a certain power and you're a long ways away, you might see a star out in the sky somewhere. And it's only later when you get a more powerful telescope or when you get closer somehow that you see that what you thought was a star is really two stars rotating around each other as what we call a binary star. When you're closer or you have more magnification, then you can see it better. So it's normal to have more detail given the closer we get to the fulfillment of an event. John is enough closer that he sees the beast from the sea accompanied by this other beast from the earth and by its image. These are the great earthly helps to the first beast. This second beast is out of the earth, and that probably emphasizes the false prophet's close association with human society. We know that the second beast, the beast from the earth, is the false prophet because we're told that in chapter 19, verse 20. We can compare that with chapter 16, verse 3 and make this inevitable connection that the second beast is called the false prophet. The two horns here on this second beast may be intended to indicate its lamb-like appearance, but it spoke as a dragon, showing its deceitful appearance. It kind of looks like a lamb, but it doesn't speak like a lamb when push comes to shove. It speaks like a dragon and has a great deal of authority. The second beast is, though, a subordinate helper to the first beast. It's the prime minister of the first beast. This lamb-like appearance suggests its pseudo-redemptive role in the imitation of the true lamb. The description would have reminded the first century reader of the imperial cult where they had to to offer a pinch of incense and say that Caesar is Lord, and its priesthood, which made the people worship the Roman emperor. Ancient sources say that this cult was transferred from Babylon to Pergamum, where for a time the kings of Pergamum were worshipped as gods in their temple by means of its priest. And then when Pergamum fell to the Romans, their worship was transferred to the Roman emperors, and the Roman imperial cult became the official state religion of the Roman Empire for a while under paganism. But the first century readers would have also understood that they were already living under the sixth head. In chapter 17, we're told that five of the heads are fallen up through Greece, as we saw last night, and there's one that now is in John's day in 96 AD. That was the pagan Roman Empire. And that this prophecy we're looking at in chapter 13 looks ahead to a seventh head, which would be killed and resurrected as an eighth, according to Revelation 17:10. So the people in the first century could see that this was not being fulfilled in their time, even though they had the Roman imperial cult that sounded something like what was being talked about here. They could have included that the implied priesthood, even though much like the pagan priesthood in their own day, was pertaining to some future time when there was going to be something that was fairly similar. The Lord warned his followers, "Watch out that nobody deceives you, because many will come in my name claiming I am the Christ and will deceive many." Matthew chapter 24, verses 4 and 5. "For false Christ and false prophets will appear. They will perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect if that were possible." Matthew 24, 24. We've got to be on the alert to detect deceptive false doctrine. In verse 12 of chapter 13, we're told that the beast exercised all the authority of the first beast on behalf of the first beast. He made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast. Like the first beast, which functions as an instrument of Satan, so this beast exercises that same satanic power. He functions as an intermediary, in an intermediary priestly manner between the first beast and the people. He was seen to perform great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven in full view of men. The apparent miracles of the beast from the earth mimic the miracles of the true witnesses. This beast from the earth, called the false prophet in chapter 19, verse 20, is seen in order to tell the people to set up an image in honor of the first beast. This idea was, I think, clear to the first century reader because the priest in the imperial cult required the statue, required the people in Ephesus to put up a statue and worship the likeness of the emperor Domitian, who was ruling at this time, as John was writing, in the form of this colossal statue. The statue had a head, face that looked like the face of Domitian. So they were familiar with this idea of an image, and they knew that the book of Revelation was presented in symbolic language, so they wouldn't necessarily have expected this to be a literal image, but they were familiar with the idea of having an image of whoever it was that was ruling. So they would have understood that the image is something that reflects the character of the first beast, something that would be able to effectively communicate for the false prophet in requiring the worship of the first beast. I believe that the beast from the earth, the false prophet, is the Roman Catholic priesthood or clergy, including and especially the College of Cardinals, the higher up, the upper echelons here. It functions contemporaneously with the beast from the sea. It is a deceptive entity because it seems to be mild and gentle and inoffensive, but the more power it gets, the more damage it does. It ensured the torture and death of countless witnesses to the true gospel. Bishops were bishops by the grace of the apostolic see, not by the grace of God. The bishops or mitres martyr, that hat that looks kind of like a thumbnail, it used to be turned the other way so that it was split in the top and it kind of looked like a couple of horns. There are two horns mentioned here, and it kind of looked like the way they used to wear these hats. They kind of looked like a couple of horns. Whether you think that's significant or not, it's a fact of history that they used to wear it sideways like that. It was called cornuti, which means horned. In the days of Leo X and Eugenius IV and Pope Martin V, there was a medal created of the Pope seated on his throne, attended by cardinals. This is one example of it, and I don't know if the lighting allows you to see it very well or not. But the Pope is seated on his throne. He is being attended by cardinals who seem to be placing his crown upon the head, but there are other cardinals over here,
And I don't know if you can see that very well or not, but they've got that cornuti on. It has those horns there, and they're bowing down in front of the Pope. Let me see if I can get a... This is one from the time of Martin V. Maybe it's a little clearer. Same picture, but maybe a little more clearly given there. And you can see those split hats there that just look like a couple of horns, like what we read about in the 13th chapter of Revelation. But the thing I wanted you to see here is that there is a Latin inscription. Down here it says Rome. But there's a Latin inscription that says, Quem creant adorant. Speaking of the College of Cardinals. Quem creant adorant.
That's a Latin expression meaning, whom they create, they adore. They get together in a conclave, as you know, because we had this happen not long ago in Rome. And when the smoke comes out of the chimney, it has the meaning that a new pope has been selected by the College of Cardinals. First they create him, and then they bow down to him and adore him. And this is not only admitted, but it's right on the medal here that this is what they do. Right, this is a medal that they themselves put out. Here's another example of this same picture, this time from Eugenius IV. I don't know if that's better or worse to view, but anyway, that's what it says in the Latin language. So it seems to me to go right along with what we're reading about here. You've got a beast from the earth that's working in close conjunction with the beast from the sea. It creates the Pope, and then it acts in subservience to him as its prime minister. And the College of Cardinals is the ones that do this, that are a part of this beast from the earth. I believe the image is fulfilled in the papal general councils that are held periodically still, but have been held all through the years since the power of the papacy began. An image represents the original of the thing. Whatever it's a likeness of, it represents that. The papal councils were representative in nature. Gibbon said, it was established as a custom and a law that the bishops of the independent churches should meet in the capital of the province at the stated periods of spring and autumn. Their decrees, which were styled canons, regulated every important controversy of faith and discipline. All the provinces of the Roman Empire were represented by their bishops under the sanction and presidency of the popes. It's these councils, I believe, that are the image of the beast. The word image is used quite frequently of deliberative bodies like the House of Commons in Great Britain or the French National Assembly in Paris. Edmund Burke, who wrote Reflections on the Revolution in France, and a famous writer that I think you're familiar with, Edmund Burke had this to say: the virtue, spirit, and essence of a House of Commons consists in its being the express image of the feelings of a nation. Sir James Graham, speaking about a reform bill which was to constitute the House of Commons a real and express image and representation of the country. The French National Assembly in 1848 was said to be a faithful and complete image of the nation of France. In other words, it represented what the French people believed and thought. This is also found in the language of the church councils themselves. I'm not going to quote from those, but that information is easily obtainable if you want it. So the councils were referred to as the image of the Pope, or the image of the church. The Pope, as the head of the Roman priesthood, is the one who calls for the convening of a general council, and the whole preparatory process for it is assigned to the papal clergy, the prime minister of the Pope. To give breath to the image is to enable it to speak, and that's exactly what they do. Only the clergy were allowed to vote regarding ecclesiastical matters. The decisions of the council were called canons, and the councils were said to speak these canons. It was the image of the Pope that spoke, because what the council said was the representation and the image of the papal mind. This is how tradition came to be elevated so far above the Word of God, through these councils that made up new laws and said that God was inspiring these laws. Anybody who was excommunicated was outside the protection of the law. Anyone could kill them with impunity. Most of the Western general councils made specific provision for the extermination of heretics. The extermination of heretics they called the extirpation of heretics. And this was the object of many, many bulls of the councils. I think I cited a few examples of that last night, perhaps. Death was decreed and a provision was made for accomplishing the death of the heretics, forbidding that any should harbor the heretics while they were alive or, when dead, give them a Christian burial. Trade with the heretics was forbidden by canon law. The Third Lateran Council in 1179 said, it commanded that no man should entertain or cherish them, the heretics, in his house or on his land, or exercise traffic with them. The Synod of Tours in 1163 specifically forbade buying and selling with heretics, as did the Pope Martin's bull at the Constance Council from 1414 to 1418. The mark of the beast in the right hand or the forehead is the sign of ownership. This mark is the alternative to the seal in chapter 7. That seal in chapter 7 identified the people of God. But the Antichrist was going to claim ownership of these people who have this mark, and those who are deceived by the false prophet. The mark would be seen in the actions or the characteristics which would identify a person with the Antichrist. It was not a literal physical mark, but it was seen in the profession or activity of people. The mark of the beast is the name of the beast or the number of his name. And we have an instruction in the last couple of verses there. There is an instruction to count or calculate the number of his name. This suggests that this number is a gematria in which the name is hidden in the numbers. It's just a figure of speech where the numbers are understood as corresponding letters. We don't have that in our language, and so it might be a little bit hard to grasp the concept, but it shouldn't be too hard because we're all familiar with Roman numerals, where letters stand for numbers. They didn't have other numbers. They just used letters, and they doubled as both letters and numbers. Like the letter X stood for 10. Everybody knows that. The letter C stood for 100. The letter I in Roman numerals stood for 1. So in the Greek language, it was the same thing. And we're told to calculate or count this number. The expression there, let him calculate, literally means to calculate with stones, implying some sort of an arithmetical procedure. The abacus was already in common use at this time. This implies a decimal approach to the calculation of the number, which would greatly limit the number of possibilities which could result from your calculation. The same word, let him count, is used in Luke 14:28. If you're going to build a tower, you must first sit down and count the cost, calculate the cost. Same word there. The solution to this gematria should have been one which was easy for the first century readers to understand and to find. We need to remember, of course, that the Apostle John wrote in the Greek language for people who understood the Greek language. Jesus, even though Greek was not his first language, when he's come back to give the revelation, he says, I am Alpha and Omega. That shows he's keying into, of all the alphabets of the earth, he's keying into the Greek alphabet in a book that's being written in the Greek language. These were, of course, the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet, Alpha and Omega. The Greeks did not express numbers by figures like we do, but they expressed them by letters like the Romans did with their Roman numerals. 666 was expressed by using letters, which were not only letters, but they were also symbols for various quantities. There was a solution offered by Irenaeus in the 2nd century that I still think has never been bested. I believe this to be the correct solution. And I'll just put it up here in front of your eyes. You can see what you think of it. Now that's a lambda, which has a numerical value of 30 in the Greek language. You can look this up online independent sources. You can look it up I have a Encyclopedia Britannica, which my wife and I bought in 1976, long before we knew we ever would have the internet. Now it just sits on the shelf pretty much unused, but in that, it gives these numerical values for the Greek letters, the same as it gives the values of the Latin letters for the Roman numbers. So this is not something that somebody has made up to try to make this name come out right. These are well-known numerical values. The letter Alpha is worth one. It's the first letter of the Greek alphabet. And then we go to tau and epsilon and iota, nu, omicron, and sigma, with the corresponding values there. When we add these up, we come up with the number 666. Irenaeus in the second century came up with this, and I think he's absolutely right about it. This, with its diphthong, or gliding vowel, is the Greek spelling of Latinos, or Latinus. If we bring it into, if we anglicize it, it would be Latinus. And Latinus, or Latinos, the Latin man, was the king of the Latins and the reputed founder of the Latin race. And as I've said before, I see some people maybe trying to copy some of that down. I'll put that back up there for a moment. But as I've said before, whatever is on these slides is available to you. I think some of you had some of it emailed to you already maybe, so it's freely available to you. Don't feel like you have to copy anything down. This Latinos is mentioned a couple of times in Virgil's Aeneid. Most people don't read that anymore like people used to in school, but it's the story of Aeneas, who was a Trojan from the Trojan War, who in exile travels to Italy and there is hosted, when he gets to Italy at Rome, he is hosted by Latinus with his men. Rome is the ancient capital of the Latins. The Romans were a Latin race. They spoke the Latin language. It was the Latin world, the Latin kingdom, the Latin church, the Latin patriarch, the Latin clergy, the Latin councils. They Latinized everything. The Roman church is called the Latin church to distinguish it from the Greek church, which is the other division of the Great Schism. Roman Catholic books are written in the Latin language. Until recently, its worship was conducted in every country in the Latin language alone. If you're old enough, you can remember when that was changed and what a great uproar it caused among the Catholics in our country when suddenly the Mass was going to be in English. Who could conceive of that? It always had been in Latin everywhere. And so Latinus, the Latin man, is a good representation of this whole system. When a Roman Catholic council convenes, even yet, its sessions are conducted in the Latin language alone. The language of the emperor and all the official Roman affairs, even including the army, were conducted in the Latin language, even while the lingua franca of the empire was Greek. But it was everything official was conducted in the Latin language because it was a Latin Roman empire. Latinos, Latinus, the Latin man, was a clear way of referring to anybody who represented the authority of the Roman Empire. Irenaeus in the second century said that this is the probable solution because it is the name of the last kingdom of the four seen by Daniel. And as I say, I've never seen it bested. If you have, I'd be interested in that. But I believe this to be the correct solution. It points ahead to a future Roman head of state. The beast and one of its heads, though conceivably separated in the first two verses of chapter 13, are treated as identical here in verses 12 and 14. So if we discover the name of the man, it is the name of the beast. At the end of the book of Daniel, the statement is made there that none of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. Here is wisdom. This calls for wisdom and understanding. That's probably enough for chapter 13, unless somebody has a question or thought about anything in chapter 13. We get to something a lot happier in chapter 14. This is the concluding portion of the little scroll message as introduced in chapter 10, where John was shown a little scroll, small enough that it lay completely open in the hand of the angel, and he was told to eat that scroll and ingest it, digest it, and then he was going to prophesy again. And we've been seeing him doing that now in chapter 11, 12, and 13. Here we come to the conclusion. Chapter 14 is rather simple compared to some of the things we've been looking at in the last couple of chapters. It just presents three scenes. First, we have the Lamb and the 144,000 in verses 1 through 5. We have the three flying angels in verses 6 through 13. And then we have the wheat and grape harvest in chapters 14 through 20. Here we have another proleptic interlude that's looking ahead to the culmination of history. This is so much more cheerful than the message of the two beasts that we just read about in chapter 13. Remember, after we had seen the the fall of the Western of paganism in the days of Constantine, and the great struggle, the great earthquake, the turmoil that was going on, those 10 waves of Roman pagan Roman persecution under the fifth seal. After we had seen all that in chapter 6, then we had inserted chapter 7 as a proleptic scene ahead showing the salvation of the faithful of God. And it was placed there just as a relief of all the things that the people had been thinking about under the symbolism of chapter 6. This, I think, is very similar in the little scroll message. It's placed as a relief to show that if we stay with the Lord, everything's going to come out all right. It's just a proleptic interlude looking ahead to the culmination of history, and it's much more cheerful than what we've been thinking about. It's inserted here to give comfort, hope, and encouragements to the Christians. We're told here that in verse 12, this makes it possible. The fact that we have something great coming makes it more easy. It makes it much more possible for the saints to steadfastly endure to the end, to be faithful unto death. When you know ahead of time what's going to happen, and that as long as you stick with the Lord, everything's going to be all right, then you can have patience and wait for it. These people at the end of the first century were wondering, under the persecution of Diocletian, what's going to happen? How's this all going to turn out? The book of Revelation is telling them that everything is going to be all right. You know, we talk about how awful it was to be put to death for your faith, but truth be told, sometimes it's easier to die for the faith than it is to just live in the faith week after week, month after month, year after year. Sometimes it would be easier to be a dead sacrifice than to be a living sacrifice. If you just make that one-time good decision to allow them to kill you, if they will, to persecute you for your faith, then you're fine once they kill you. But when they're not killing you, In our situation now, we're living sacrifices, and we need to be committed in season, out of season, through thick and thin, sometimes over several decades after we come to Christ. That's easier to do, I think, perhaps, than allow yourself to be killed for the faith. Chapters 11 through 13 contain a number of chronological indicators that give us clues for understanding the times of fulfillment, with the exception of the passing of the second woe in chapter 11, verse 14. These function independently from the chronology of the seven-sealed scroll, but they also function in a complementary manner. Let's take a little look at this chapter. Verses 1 through 5, I believe, is referring ahead to the post-resurrection state. We just finished seeing the lamb-like beast. We're going from the lamb-like beast, the beast from the earth, to the Lamb of God. We just saw false worship. Now we're looking at true worship. Mount Zion that's mentioned here is the place of God's dwelling. Mount Zion was actually the highest spot in Jerusalem, even higher than Mount Moriah, where the temple stood. This is the highest spot in the heavenly Jerusalem that the writer of the Hebrew letter talks about in Hebrews 12, 22. And what Paul was referring to, the Jerusalem which is above is free, which is the mother of us all, Galatians 4, 26. The Lamb is the victor, and He reigns with His people. The angels could not learn the song of the redeemed. Only those who were redeemed could learn the song of the redeemed and could sing it. So the saints, all the saints, I believe, are represented by the 144,000 here. We talked about that concept back in chapter 7, and I don't think we need to repeat all of that now. All the saints are represented by the 144,000. Holy, holy, holy is what the angels sing, and we expect to help them make the courts of heaven ring. But when we sing redemption song, they will fold their wings, for angels never felt the joy that our salvation brings. There was no plan of redemption provided for the fallen angels. So only humans can be redeemed and know the joy that comes with that. These redeemed kept themselves pure. No lie was found in their mouths. Their counterparts received not the love of the truth and submitted to strong delusion that they should believe a lie. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 11. The redeemed are blameless. There is no charge against them sustainable by evidence. They follow the Lamb wherever He goes. You know, half a century ago in the church, we had a huge issue over the idea of fellowship and just how much tolerance should be allowed in fellowship and so forth and so on. Just a huge issue. Churches were split over this, and there was a great deal of turmoil. You know what I've learned in the last 50 years? In the last 50 years, I've learned that if we get the fellowship right, the fellowship will take care of itself. We get that fellowship right. We follow the Lamb whithersoever He goes. We follow in His footsteps, at His guidance. There's nothing to be lost. There's everything to be gained. And fellowship will take care of itself. The question is, where is Jesus going? We want to follow Him wherever He goes. I like to follow somebody who's going where I need to go. Not too many years ago, I was on my way over to Bolivar, Pennsylvania to teach at their summer camp out, as they used to call it. And when I go over there, if I have time, I like to go up to Bethany, West Virginia, where Alexander Campbell used to live. I think it's kind of inspiring just to go to his house and go to the room at the library where his books and letters still are, and go to the graveyard where his wives and children and he himself now are buried. I like to go there. So I was driving along, and I was almost to his house when here was my daughter and her family in their vehicle. They were going over to the same place to teach also. Neither one of us had any idea that we were going to Bethany, knew that the other one was, but here we were arriving there at the same time. Well, when we left Bethany, I just followed them. And that was my kind of driving. All I got to do is watch that back bumper. Don't have to care where we turn or how fast we're going. I know John's not going to speed, so I just go right along. And that's the kind of driving I like. I like to follow somebody who's going where I need to go. And if you follow the Lord, you will go where you want to go, where you need to go. The redeemed are offered as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. The song that they sing is a new song. It never could have been sung previously. They did not defile themselves with women, probably speaking primarily of spiritual adultery, but the physical would be included, of course, as well. They were free of that as well. In verses 6 through 13, this addresses the future just as emphatically as if it were present. The first of the three flying angels had the eternal gospel to proclaim. Men come and go, but the gospel remains. This verse, by the way, that sixth verse, Alexander Campbell printed on the flyleaf of the Millennial Harbinger because he believed he was living this. That's why he called his paper the Millennial Harbinger. He believed that he was, through his work, helping to bring this about. In verse 7, we see the earth, the sea, and the waters. Interesting that they're put this way because these are the subjects of the first three bowls of wrath, as we're going to see them in chapter 16. The earth and the sea and the waters, each one of them has a separate bowl of wrath poured out upon it, and we see the results in chapter 16. The changes brought about in the time of the French Revolution gave an immense impulse to the spread of the gospel, but we'll have to wait till we get to chapter 16 and follow it, the rest of the book really, to talk more about that. The second angel announces the fall of Babylon, which is the Roman anti-Christian power. This seems to be the same angel and the same cry that we have later on over in the first three verses of chapter 18, in which chapter this story of the fall of Babylon is told in much greater detail. The reason for the judgment on Babylon is that she made the nations to drink of the wine of her fornication. The greatest enemy to the spread of the true knowledge of God has always been false profession of His name. And the third angel announces that the wrath of God is going to be poured out on those who worship the beast. It's going to be poured out on anybody who does that. The messages of the second and third angels are clearly dependent on what we've seen in chapters 11 through 13. So these three messages are a unity, and they're bringing us up more into modern times. The Reformation influences, the renewal of the preaching of the gospel. The theme of the little scroll, remember, is the disclosure of the little horn. It's a little book about the little horn. Here at the conclusion of the little scroll, we have a look ahead to the fall of Babylon. And the repetition of the phrase fallen here, is fallen, enhances the emphatic quality of the second angel's message. This is the same language we had back in Isaiah 21. Isaiah 21:9. Babylon is fallen. All the images of her gods lie shattered on the grounds. Now Isaiah is using once again what we've called before the prophetic perfect. He uses the past tense to emphasize the certainty of what is still yet to come. He was looking ahead to the future fall of literal Babylon in Isaiah 21. But he says, it is fallen. It is fallen. Using the present tense or the past tense to emphasize something that was yet in the future. Here in Revelation 14, we have the same past tense to emphasize the certainty of the fall of spiritual Babylon. Clear back in the fourth chapter of the book of Daniel, verses 30 and 31, Nebuchadnezzar said, "Is not this great Babylon which I have built?" He's looking out over the literal city of Babylon. "Is not this great Babylon which I have built by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" And while the words were still on his lips, his royal authority was removed from him. Later, Babylon became an apocalyptic symbol for Rome. We see this in lots of apocalyptic literature, possibly even in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 13, where Babylon is mentioned there. Rome is referenced in Revelation as Babylon the Great. The seven heads are identified with the seven hills of the great seven-hilled city, which rules over the kings of the earth, according to chapter 17, verse 18. For first century readers, there was no question but what that city was, the city of Rome. The prediction is that the time will come when the deceptive tactics which deceive the nations are going to stop working. They've worked so well for so long, but the time is going to come when they will fail to work. She made the nations drunk with the wine of her fornication. The use of wine to intoxicate and thereby deceive somebody was just as commonplace in ancient times as it is today. And this is old hat. We're all familiar with this concept. Get somebody drunk, and then they will more easily do what you want them to do. And to make it more effective, sometimes the alcohol was mixed with other mind-altering drugs. We think of Rohypnol today, for example, the so-called date rape drug, which is put into a girl's drink on probably every major college campus in America at some time during a school year, and used as a date rape drug. Deception is one of the defining characteristics of the little horn. Deception is the livelihood, and deception is the lifestyle of the great prostitute. She was the alleged wife of the Lord. Hence, her unchastity is also adultery. The intoxicating wine of the little horn's deceptions is exchanged for the wine of God's fury of judgment in the fires of Gehenna, not diluted but poured out full strength. Long have they defied the Lord's reign with impunity, and now the great day of accounting has come. The punishment will be sufficient in every individual case to satisfy the justice of the holy wrath of God. The smoke of their torment ariseth forever and ever, he says. This is contrasted with the blessed state of the righteous dead. From henceforth, from the present time, as you face persecution from Rome in the future, this blessing will have added meaning during the 1260 days. Whenever the hope of the believer is addressed explicitly in Scripture, it always refers to the post-resurrection state. That's what we're looking forward to. And I never feel like we're stopping in a very convenient place, but we have come to the time that we need to stop, so somebody might come back tomorrow night. So we'll just leave it there. We'll talk about the rest of 14. There's very little left to say on chapter 14, and then there'll be very little to say on chapter 15 because it's just an introduction to chapter 16. So we should get well into chapter 16 tomorrow night, Lord willing, which is pretty straightforward, just the pouring out of one bowl of wrath after another, but each of them on a different place with a different meaning, and that I think it will be helpful for us to look at that together. Any announcements we need to make?